The Migration Policy Institute hosts a panel discussion on the federal role in immigrant integration, examining policy more broadly and focusing on areas where greater coordination and funding might be necessary. The panel is moderated by Michael Fix, MPI Senior Vice President and Co-Director of MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and was held in conjunction with the 2010 E Pluribus Unum Prizes recognizing exceptional immigrant integration initiatives.
Look, I'm absolutely, first of all, I'm very much a rookie at this Charlie Rose thing, so please bear with me on this. I'm really delighted to get the chance, how does this mic go? To get the chance along with you to be able to listen to this panel. The panel really has four purposes, as I see it. We'll answer four broad questions. The first is to give you a sense of how immigrants and immigrant integration issues are cutting across the missions of five agencies that have not historically been assigned the mission of immigrant integration, but whose roles are absolutely critical to the lives of immigrants and whose programs are absolutely critical to the lives of immigrants at the state and at the federal level. Second, I hope that the panelists will share with us their insider views, both from the state perspective and from a Washington perspective, about what the critical policy choices they're facing are going to be in the near term and in the intermediate term. And the policy choices that, of course, we're the most focused in on are the impacts on immigrants. And especially, we'll want to focus the panel on the impacts of the recession on their typical programmatic intercessions when it comes to the immigrant population. Third, as we have heard, one of the awardees of the EPUP program of awards today has been the state of Illinois. It was the first state, as Suzette told us, to adopt an executive order, and as such, it seems to me it represents something of an exemplary program in terms not just of programmatically, but in terms of immigration and immigrant integration governance. And so I think that, for me, will serve as a point of departure to ask the question, if we have an executive order at the state level, what are the implications for national leadership on the issue of immigrant integration? And in particular, is the time ripe to start to think hard about a national office on not just refugees, but refugee and immigrant integration policy? And then finally, I hope within the time period that we'll be able to get our distinguished panel to address the question of the DREAM Act and of comprehensive immigration reform and what they might hold for immigrant integration policy. And in particular, what should the shape of an integration title be within the compass of comprehensive immigration reform, and in particular within that, a number of us have thought about an impact aid program, and what should an impact aid program look like? Now, you have their bios in your programs. You cannot believe how relieved I was to see all five of them show up. And how privileged I feel to be able to turn the floor over to them. You have their full distinguished careers in your bios, but let me just hit the tops of the trees so that you get to know them just a little bit. I'll start on the far right with Mark Greenberg. Mark is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in HHS's Administration on Children and Families. He was, among his many other careers, he was the director of policy for the very influential Center for Law and Social Policy. Next, sitting next to Mark is John Trasvina. Mark is the current Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. He's a former executive director of MALDEF, and even in an earlier life, he was the head of the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices in the Department of Justice, a long title, but an important position. Grace Ho, sitting here, second to my left, is Assistant Secretary at Illinois Department of Human Services. As you've heard, she has been a co-winner of this year's E Pluribus Unum Prize, and she will be lionized at the award ceremony later, so I won't say anything about her. Sitting to Grace's left is Sherry Steisel. Sherry has many titles. Among them is Senior Director of the Human Services Committee at the National Conference of State Legislatures. However, particularly importantly, Sherry has served as a distinguished member of the E Pluribus Unum Prize's advisory panel for 2 years. She's read lots of proposals, and we are deeply, deeply appreciative. And then finally, sitting to my left is Felicia Escobar from the White House Domestic Policy Council. She was formerly an attorney with Senator Ken Salazar, who's now the Interior Secretary, and while she was with Senator Salazar, she played a very central role in the framing of the 2006 and 2007 comprehensive immigration reform legislation. So this is really quite a panel. We'll have them talk for about 30, 35 minutes about a range of issues briskly, and then we will open it up to questions. It's late in the day, and I think, can I start with Mark? Can I start with you? And can I ask you, because what I think is that the administration on children and families is not the federal agency that comes first to mind when we think of immigrant integration in some ways, but it is the heart and soul, and it is a mainstay of the U.S. safety net. I wondered if you would say a few words about how your mission intersects with the issue of immigrant integration, particularly in light of your focus on young children, and given the fact that young children of immigrants are such a large share of the rising child population.
Sure. So first, thank you very much. Thank you, all of you in attendance. Thanks to the Migration Policy Institute and to Michael for his kind introductory remarks. And as I imagine people have said it many times in the day, for Michael's extraordinary career and his extraordinary accomplishments and dedication.
I'm sure they have been thinking it.
I'm sure they've been thinking it throughout the day. So I do appreciate having been invited to be part of the exchange. As Michael indicates, I'm in the part of HHS called the Administration for Children and Families. This is the part that is less about healthcare, more about the human services part of HHS. So it encompasses the welfare reform efforts, child care, child support, child welfare, Head Start, low-income energy assistance, the social service block grants to states, and then a whole set of initiatives under the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So for us, in a number of the programs that we work with on a day-to-day basis, there are, of course, ongoing issues around eligibility for benefits that relate to the choices that Congress has made as to the circumstances under which immigrants are and aren't eligible for a range of benefits. And in those circumstances in which they are eligible, the access to the programs can play an important role in promoting integration, notably when Michael highlighted early childhood, both in childcare and Head Start, significant opportunities in both of those programs, both for supporting the work of parent and the development of children. The Office of Refugee Resettlement operates a range of programs, a number focused explicitly on refugees, but in addition to that, also victims of trafficking, victims of torture, and for refugee resettlement, it is a combination of cash assistance, medical assistance, social services with a very strong emphasis on integration, particularly through rapidly linking newly entering refugees and asylees and other eligible individuals with employment. Along with the strong employment focus, a connection to English language learning and to a set of other social services to help the eligible participants in the program effectively integrate into their communities.
Mm-hmm. Are there any policy choices that are coming down the pike that this audience that's interested in immigrant integration and immigration broadly should keep their eye on within the administration on children and families that you're going to be grappling with as the director of policy within the agency?
Well,
that could be not just necessarily ones that are targeted, but those that are general.
Sure. Well, I mean, I should highlight several things that were in our budget request for this year.
Excellent.
So one is just for refugee assistance in the initial months in which refugees are in the country, they can qualify within existing funding for up to 8 months of cash assistance and medical assistance over that period. The Congress appropriates a fixed amount of money. There are always challenges in knowing how many people are going to need it and how long they're going to need it. We've asked Congress to make available a contingency fund to better address the needs and to ensure we're able to do so. On the social services side, one of the things that we've asked for this year is additional funding for intensive case management. And that is based upon a recognition that for a number of refugee populations coming in, the challenges are greater, the needs are greater, and we think the need for a more intensive approach to case management and connection to services is increasingly important.
A departure somewhat in terms of...
Excuse me?
Well, a departure in terms of more intensive case management.
That's right. Well, a continuation and extension, but I've been trying to build on.
Excellent. John, I have a question for you. So people don't... Similarly, people don't typically associate the Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity with an immigration or an immigrant agenda, but you've obviously been interested and been involved in these issues centrally through a lot of your career here. What's the intersection now between HUD's OFAO and immigration and immigrant integration? And does the recent proliferation of state and local ordinances, and some of which reach to the issue of residential discrimination, or would on the face of it bar undocumented immigrants from housing, will your office be involved? How will it implicate what you do in the day-to-day?
We are very involved. I want to thank you, Michael, and it's great to see so many of my longtime friends on these issues. And some people thought when I left MALDEF to join the administration and come into Fair Housing that I'd be stepping away from these issues. But these issues are critically important. As all of you know, while mayors and governors cannot set and enforce immigration laws, they are really front and center on issues of immigrant integration. And it is critically important that whether we look at fair housing or transforming HUD in general, that immigrants and immigration policies are very much at the forefront of what we're doing, even currently now in Tennessee and in Oklahoma, to make sure that non-English speakers and people who are afraid of coming forward to FEMA are coming forward to get assistance. You cannot have real assistance. You cannot have real addressing of emergency situations without understanding people's immigration, the rationales for them not coming forward, and look, and so our office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity, I see it as a gateway. It's a gateway for marginalized people. While we have the traditional protected classes under the statute of race, national origin, color, religion, etc., in every aspect, those who are newcomers can be assisted through our programs. So, for example, on affirmatively furthering fair housing, as we look at HUD and looking at the various issues that HUD tackles, coming into this, I think a lot of people didn't really look at HUD as a particularly as a place to go. But as you talk about a national office on immigrant integration, while on the one hand you want to make sure that office, if it is established, does not give everyone else a pass and say, well, that office can take care of it. But that office would need to have the kinds of resources and leverage of the various departments. HUD is a very logical place to look for immigrant integration. It goes beyond education, it goes beyond jobs, it goes beyond housing, it goes beyond civil rights and DHS issues. All are encompassed in what we talk about in affirmatively furthering fair housing, connecting housing to opportunities. And reducing segregation. After all, we have now with the Latino students the highest levels of segregation. And in 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Seattle and Louisville public schools cases really tied the hands of school districts to try to address school segregation. So if school segregation cannot be addressed in the classroom by educators, you look back at the reasons, and it's housing segregation. So HUD has a role in breaking down segregation and creating places of opportunity. So as we look at HUD, in particular, the current situation going on in Arizona, we have a situation where there's a conflict, potential conflict, between the various fears as well as the actual provisions of 1070 and federal law. Now, I would defer, and we do defer to the Justice Department on the overall issue of preemption, and perhaps Felicia can comment on that. But there's some direct conflicts between what on the housing issues in Arizona, and we must make clear that the federal fair housing laws continue to apply in Arizona as well as the other 49 states, so that those who might use that 1070 as a way to single out their tenants or check their tenants' immigration status, either in a reasonable fear, incorrect, but a fear that the harboring provision applies to their tenants, which it does not, or in retaliation. If a Latino tenant says, I've got a problem with the appliances, or I have a problem with the conditions, we cannot allow that law to be used as a trump card in retaliation for those claims. So we're working at the local level to make sure that those kinds of fears are taken away. Similarly, some of the other ordinances that have come across over the last few years, the rental ordinances, while HUD has not played a major role, it certainly conflicts, any ordinance that is passed potentially conflicts with any HUD municipal recipients' obligations to affirmably further fair housing. We certainly would look at that in terms of our compliance.
Excellent. So most of those strategies that you talked about are essentially information strategies, right? Outreach strategies, information strategies. One of the things that OFEO does that is very interesting is it tests for discrimination. Is there any thought to expanding the testing regimes that you... This is paired testing to see for discrimination with which I've been associated in an earlier career. Is there any thought to expand that to include immigrant-like populations or immigrant populations?
Well, after all, Title VIII covers national origin. So there needs to be that bridge. And we certainly are going to continue to do the national origin discrimination testing for Asian American community, the Latino community, and pairing in the bridge to language also is one that I think would encompass immigration related discrimination. But it's not just outreach; it is actual enforcement. Enforcement of the fair housing laws, national origin discrimination. So we have a number of cases being brought where immigration certainly comes into play.
Grace. In addition to being the winner of the E Pluribus Unum Award, you were also on the cover of Forbes magazine as having one of the economies in the toughest shape. And here you are administering a large safety net, the safety net program essentially for the state of Illinois, as well as a lot of programs that directly influence immigrants and their integration. Could you talk to us for just a little bit about what points, where the recession and where budget cuts are really going to pinch in terms of your immigrant-related programs? Who's going to be hurt? What you're trying to shore up?
Sure. So as it relates to our fiscal year 11 budget in Illinois, our budget starts in July, and we still don't have any certainty as to what our budget's going to look like for fiscal year 11. But so the point of reference that I can speak about is what the governor introduced back in March to the General Assembly and to the people of Illinois. And one of the biggest concerns that I have in our human services budget, and human services in Illinois includes services for people with developmental disabilities, mental illness, substance abuse issues, maternal child health programs, after school programs, domestic violence assistance, vocational rehabilitation services. And those, I think, and of course, we're the front door for TANF, Medicaid, SNAP, as well as the child care program. And so we've worked with Mark many times in the past to look at how we can improve our programs. But I think the stimulus, and I think that this is probably true for many states, is it's been a help as well as a hindrance as it relates to certain policies that we're kind of backing into as a result. And one of the primary issues that I see of concern is that, you know, in putting our budget together in the Department of Human Services, as you can imagine, we have a healthy number of programs that are Medicaid-funded and Medicaid-supported. And so with the enhanced match as a part of the stimulus package, if we change any eligibility associated with Medicaid eligibility, then we sacrifice the enhanced match from the federal government, which means billions and billions of dollars for the state of Illinois. And so as a result, one of the tenets in putting our budget together is that we cannot touch any Medicaid programs, no Medicaid eligibility changes, et cetera, which is great for the Medicaid population, but I think the damage it does is for the non-Medicaid population. And so in our introduced budget, we're cutting all non-Medicaid services for people with developmental disabilities, we're cutting all non-Medicaid services for people with mental illness, and we're cutting all non-Medicaid services for people with physical disabilities. And so I think all of us know what the ramifications of that may be. And certainly I know that this is not a budget, and we've said this publicly. Thankfully, we're able to say with our secretary and as well as the governor is that this is not a budget that is based on our values in Illinois. It's based on the revenue that we have in Illinois, and there's a revenue battle going on in Illinois, such as in other states. But the stimulus, I think, helps us because it brings in more revenue, but the parameters are making us back into a policy in Illinois where human services is basically going to be a Medicaid program. And, you know, I'm not an expert as it relates to the nuances of the health care reform package, and I understand that the number of and percentage of people on Medicaid will dramatically increase over the coming years, but that still, as we know, leaves a good portion of individuals who will still be left out. And immigrants and refugees factor greatly into that scenario. As it relates to immigrant refugee funding specific programs, I think we've had a very robust niche funding for immigrants and refugees over the past many, many years. I know Ed Silverman, who works in the Department of Human Services, has worked with a lot of people on this panel over the past many years and is seen as a pioneer in state-funded programs. Thankfully, and I think a large part of this is due to the momentum we've built, not only through the executive order, but in partnership with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights in Illinois, which has become a force to be reckoned with in Illinois and has created a foundation within the General Assembly where you don't really want to mess with the immigrant refugee money. It's I think, a modest amount enough where the bark isn't worth the bite or the whatever, but you get my so you know there are going to be nicks and cuts and most likely you know a percentage decrease as we have seen in most programs, but not a disproportionate amount. And I know you know Denise Martinez is here from the governor's office in Illinois. I know that there continues to be a very strong commitment in meeting immigrant and refugee needs. And I think the last thing that I want to say, and I'm going to channel Josh Hoyt, who's a director of ICRR, because the question is, in times of diminishing revenues, how can you continue to invest in immigrant refugee issues? And how can you have the nerve to ask for more? And I think the answer lies in the fact that Illinois is seeing an increasingly larger percentage of new Americans, people who are legal permanent residents, people who are children of naturalized citizens. And the way that we looked at it is that for too long, their needs have gone unmet. And so we're at the point of trying to catch up.
Yes, we were very much struck. We've just done a paper that looks at the impact of the recession on spending for immigrants and refugees, both in the area of education and more broadly. And we were both struck by how powerful you were in having and averting cuts for targeted programs in the state of Illinois, particularly given what seems to be on the threshold in California, and what's happened in other states. So that leads me to Sherry. Why don't you tell us a little bit? Instead of me gassing on about the states, why don't you, as the as one of the voices, one of the principal voices of the states in terms of social welfare spending and other areas of policy, where I'll ask you the same question, essentially, that I asked Grace about Illinois. Where is the pinch coming in the recession, and what are the policy points that you're having to grapple with at the federal level, and given what you're, given how you're being...
Well, I appreciate the question, and I also very much appreciate both MPI and the Kaplan Foundation's efforts in this area to highlight immigrant integration, but also to highlight the notion of the role of state and local government in this. We often feel like the overlooked partners. Sometimes, in fact, when we, you know, it's only when something happens that's controversial that we start talking about state laws and state programs and policies that affect the immigrant population. You know, in states, we see each year an increasing number of bills and resolutions and laws, not only on enforcement, but on social services, on related to naturalization, related to education of the foreign-born, because this is an issue that affects every state now. This is not an issue that is just a few states. This is an issue that affects every state. And what we hear from state policymakers around the country is the importance of this area and also the lack of resources in this area. Integration is something that costs money. It's not only about just having a community leadership role, but also being able to support programs that provide English acquisition, dealing with English as a second language, dealing with the costs in healthcare and human services and in law enforcement. There's a variety of different kinds of efforts that states certainly put their own dollars in, but these compete in a very difficult budget environment. You know, since the recession in December 2007, states have had to close a collective $531 billion budget gap. Immigrant programs are part of those state budgets, and they're obviously vulnerable, as is every other part of state budget, of the state budget. We have across-the-board cuts, and lawmakers around the country have had to make some very difficult and often painful choices, deciding between different populations, deciding between how we provide services and making priorities, and they have not been easy. They've been incredibly difficult. And in fact, this year we have 31 states already foreseeing budget gaps in their fiscal year 2012 budget of more than $75 billion. So we have states more and more grappling. We've done all the easy cuts. Now we're down to the hard cuts. And to some extent, states have been tackling some of this by themselves. State and local government is well aware of the fact that we haven't had much effort We haven't had much success at the federal level in trying to promote larger policies and changes related to integration and related to cost sharing in this area. You know, we are longstanding supporters of having federal action on immigration. But in our view, without state impact assistance, without funds for English language attainment, without an effort that is not only an office of integration, but also some funding to provide technical assistance to state and local leaders, to nonprofit associations, to work on immigrant integration. We haven't dealt with where the rubber hits the road at the local level, where people interact with each other and the needs are very real. We won't support immigration reform if it doesn't contain those kinds of provisions, because they're that important. You know, the last time we did with an effort on comprehensive immigration reform, the last two times, there have been provisions to provide state impact assistance, which is funding for state and local government for education, both adult and at the younger child level, to provide assistance, to provide health care assistance, et cetera, because those are the areas where states bear the costs and the consequences of the lack of immigration policy decision-making now. So, you know, I think that states really are ready to be partners, and we also need assistance on best practices. especially in the integration area, where we know, for example, schools are great locations where everyone comes together, the children of the foreign-born and the children of citizens and the children of naturalized citizens. And what a wonderful area to try to build in terms of integration of all populations into our communities. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention civic integration. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, even in states that are grappling with state budget cuts, you know, a state like Missouri that got a lot of attention for a enforcement-oriented omnibus bill, also at the same time as a state that's passed additional funding for naturalization. Civic integration has to be part of this discussion as well.
Carrie, what issues are you working now at the federal level that you think are going to have an impact on immigrant populations, the ones that are going to have a disproportionate impact as you work your advocacy day to day?
Well, you know, from a state policy perspective, and NCSL is a bipartisan organization. We work with everybody. It takes three quarters of the states to agree before we articulate our positions. And one of the things that we really have focused on is state impact assistance and really ensuring that these issues come to the fore. That integration, the cost to states, and trying to work out a new state-federal partnership in the area just becomes that much more important and that much more critical, especially in a time of declining budget times. So leaders like Illinois aren't saddled with having all of the consequences and all of those costs, that there really needs to be some federal cost-sharing here and a mechanism for providing these kinds of best practices. So we have really worked hard on impact aid. We really want to talk about education, because it's critical. If we want to take it to the next step of looking at our naturalization process, people have to be able to speak English and be able to pass those tests. And we think there'll be a surge of demand and a cost shift to the states and local government that we haven't really paid attention to. So I am thrilled that we're having this conversation right now, because it'll get that message out to that many more people about the importance of these kinds of programs in our communities and having funding for them.
I'll come back to you on this, so be prepared. I want to, you know, we want your architecture of an impact aid program that we can react to. So, but before I do that, now that we've had sort of the state perspective on this, maybe we could get a little bit of the administration's perspective on immigrant integration issues and where they're really feeling that this is an issue. Which issues do they really want to dig in? Do they really think are central in the agenda? Do they want to be associated? Do they want to make progress on? And so for that, let me turn to you, Felicia.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me to speak, and it's great to be here with people who are doing such great work on this issue at the state and local level and across the executive branch. You know, at the DPC, I don't know how many people are familiar with the Domestic Policy Council, but you know, our goal and our job for the president is to help kind of determine what policies require coordination across the executive branch, and to help turn that coordination into action, hopefully to come up with good ideas and ways for agencies to work together and to push forward on an agenda. So, you know, it's a timely conversation, because we're right now thinking through budget cycles and how immigrant integration issues kind of impact agencies throughout the executive branch. So we're thinking about how we can coordinate better. And I know that you know, we have friends in different agencies. We also know that the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Citizenship, USCIS's Office of Citizenship, has received an influx of funding to really think about immigrant integration issues, and they got a small amount of money the last cycle, and have gotten an additional influx of money in this next year to provide funding for models to get national organizations to really test out and work with local agencies who are interested in creating immigrant integration kind of programs at the local level, and how they can really model those programs is going to be important information for us to glean. But you know, my colleagues throughout DPC are working on integration issues, whether it's thinking through WIA reauthorization, working on our robust education agenda, providing funding, increased funding for Pell Grants and for new generation immigrants to send their kids or themselves to college. We're thinking through those issues. ESL, ESL is obviously important. We've increased in this latest budget cycle. We asked for another $50 million to increase money for English language acquisition courses at the for adults. Obviously, that's a drop in the bucket, and we're thinking through how we can strategize and prioritize funding for other programs. Been talking with people at HHS about some of the work that they've been doing and working with my colleague Scott Busby at the National Security Council, who's thinking about refugee issues as well. So we are trying to we've been spending the last year trying to get our hands wrapped around some of the programs throughout the federal executive branch, but also thinking through kind of the big priority that DPC has and a big priority for the president is the passage of comprehensive immigration reform, which I think will need and will rely on Sherry's good work from last debates and Michael and Margie's work also on immigrant integration issues. It was an important part of the conversation in 06 and 07, but I think it's even more of a critical part of the conversation now. I worked for a senator from Colorado who believed very much in integration issues. He saw how when people talk to each other, whether it's agency to agency at the local level, mayor to social service provider, or mayor to church leader, and church leaders to their communities, you can really build trust and confidence within communities and help. And all kinds of things can come from that really aren't quantifiable. So we're thinking about how some of those ideas that have kind of trickled up at the state level, whether in Illinois or other states, and also through the support of foundations and kind of highlighted by organizations like MPI, how we can really hone in on some of those models, add some of these ideas into the discussion of CIR, and move forward with comprehensive reform that has a strong emphasis on the integration piece that sometimes has been overlooked, but it's critical. It's going to be critical to getting folks to come forward and legalize if they go through the legalization program. If they're going to qualify for that, they're going to need to feel comfortable talking to the federal government, and a lot of that will come from trust that they've built at the state and local level with their government and with leaders that will hopefully be that bridge to let folks kind of help folks get integrated and actually participate in the legalization program. There's going to be obviously requirements within the legalization program of a comprehensive immigration bill around English, jobs, all these issues kind of intersect with some of the work that's done, whether it's Department of Labor, USCIS, NDHS, or other agencies. So.
So you have to leave at 5:05. So I'm going to, and I'm watching the clock very carefully. So let me just ask you, what do you think of a National Office on Immigrant and Refugee Policy? And don't, this way you can answer honestly and run out the door. is that a set of powers that the DPC would like to seize,
Well, I mean, I think it's something we're thinking about, and it's something that I know came up during the transition, and it's something that is definitely under consideration. I think we're interested in creating mechanisms for better work to happen across the federal executive branch on integration issues. So if it means that there's a formalized office or maybe a formalized process, doesn't necessarily have to be an office, but a formalized process to get the conversation going and get agencies talking about these issues on a more regular basis. We're thinking about how exactly to make that happen. So it's a matter of whether the formalized kind of structure will kind of stem from formalized conversations, and that's what we're thinking about. Kind of what would be the best way to operationalize.
Grace, yes, that's very helpful. Grace, from the state perspective? Would this help, would an office like this help you give it work with the federal government? Talk a little bit about your relations in terms of where there's mismatches and issues that you think might be resolved. Because I think the notion of this office is that it would work horizontally in the federal government, but it would also work vertically with state and local governments, as well as being a feedback loop, not just with the immigration policy making, which is kind of sprung free with immigrant integration policy. They seem to be a left-hand and right-hand issue there, if I can be candid. So,
well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that if you look at what we did in Illinois, which was to create the Office of New Americans in 2005, and what it did for us in state government was to pretty much present all state agencies with a mandate, not to say prescriptively this is what you will do, you know, Department of Human Services or DCO Economic Opportunity. It's a mandate from the executive branch that says we want you to ask the question to your agencies that say, how are you serving immigrants and refugees? How are you making sure that your services are accessible, culturally competent, and providing meaningful access? And so the answer is not multiple choice. It's really based on where you are as an agency, what kind of commitment there has been in the past from administrators in those particular agencies. And so, you know, thankfully I've had a passion working on immigrant and refugee issues before coming to the state, and so I always keep those sunglasses on regardless of what position I sit in. And so, you know, we started working on English LEP issues when I started in 2003 at the state. And we hooked up with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant Refugee Rights and the governor's office back in 2004, and we crafted this idea of an executive order. Because we knew that things were happening and percolating within different parts of Illinois, and it made so much more sense for it to be orchestrated and for it to be a deliberate, you do this and I'll do this. And I think that part of the value in this partnership and deliberateness, especially now when no one has any money, is that we can say pretty soundly that there's no redundancy, and we're not recreating the wheel. We're really going from a point of, you know, a higher level of coordination. And so, I mean, as it relates to states interacting with our federal counterparts, and, you know, I feel like, as I told you, a fish out of water, a little fish here swimming in the big ocean, is as someone who interacts a lot with our regional office, there is a new level of openness and dialogue and back and forth, because actually our regional administrator for HHS is Crystal Thomas, who used to be the Deputy Director at Healthcare and Family Services, which is our Medicaid agency. So there's really an openness in having discussion. But I would suspect that it would be valuable from her vantage point to know that her upper management folks thinks that it's important for her to focus on immigrant and refugee issues, limited English proficient issues. I think within the past 10 years, the Office of Civil Rights has been a lot more deliberate in putting out guidance related to access for limited English proficiency. But there's still a lot of haziness as to how states are supposed to behave as a result. And so perhaps that could be the carrot and the stick.
Look, I could ask these people questions for the next 4 hours, but we only have another 10 minutes. So if there are any questions, do we have any questions in the audience? Marianne?
I'm a reporter for Education Week. This is a question for HHS. I recently interviewed Iraqi refugees in El Cajon, California, and I was surprised at how little some of these families received during that 8 months that they're first in the country. I mean, it seemed like people were barely paying for rent, let alone anything else. And I just wondered if that rate might change. Who sets the rate, and will it change soon, or will it be increased?
So in the, and you're talking about receiving the refugee cash assistance?
Yeah.
So the refugee cash assistance levels are geared to state TANF assistance levels. And TANF assistance levels are determined by each state determines its own levels. They are often extremely low. California is actually one of the higher ones, but in a number of states, they can be in the range of $300, $400 a month. So it's, again, California is one of the higher. So that is based upon the legal structure of the program, and it would ultimately call for a decision by Congress to make changes and to add more money. That would be an appropriate question to explore.
One of the striking things about this period is that despite the recession, we have increased refugee admissions to the United States, which is a very positive thing to say for the country, I think. You know, instead of closing the door, we have opened it more open in this period.
Sure. I should just emphasize on it that the amounts that people are getting, as may have been obvious from what I was saying, are essentially comparable to what is available to to citizens and to immigrants who are receiving assistance through the TANF program. So it is, to the extent to which it's an issue, it's a broader issue.
To our board member, advisory board member.
I'm Christine Brenner, and I'm a professor at Rutgers University and serve on the advisory board that had the delightful opportunity to read about all of these wonderful programs and am thrilled and honored to be here with the actual recipients. The comment that I would like to offer to Felicia is that I think that if you talk about the difference between having an office or having a process, the process to look back on is Executive Order 1366 and the Clinton administration and how laborious the process was around the issue of language access as working groups across the agencies met and pondered and met and pondered and met and pondered. And I think that were there an office that could bulldog the process that was at a high level, it would be very beneficial to the process. And so I would just recommend that you look back at that and say, was this really the best way? Or is this of so much significance nationally that we help newcomers become a part of this nation as quickly as possible, that we integrate services, that we should give that effort White House endorsement to bulldog the process?
Yeah, and I think that's what we're thinking through. You could spend a year determining what the office looks like, how many people serve there, and the structure. And we're not saying that it's never a possibility, but we're thinking through can we already start meeting across agencies without needing to have some kind of formal office in place. And I think that's what we're thinking through. And the Domestic Policy Council does that on a number of issues where there's maybe not a formal office within the Domestic Policy Council on urban affairs, but there's obviously in urban affairs people who work on urban affairs issues and brings people together. So that we're definitely thinking about kind of past models and current models that are being used right now across the DPC and other agencies. So thank you for that.
Yes. John, please.
For having this on the agenda of every office, every immigration affects every family, every business, every community, right within HUD, community planning and development. How could you give out money, billions of dollars of money, neighborhood stabilization, without talking about the impact of immigrants? Public housing, important place for immigrant integration. Post comprehensive immigration reform, we'll have other issues dealing with eligibility. Certainly, my office in Fair Housing, we've translated over 100 HUD documents into 16 different languages. So there's just in HUD, there's a number of areas where immigrant integration can be, let alone all the other agencies.
Has HUD done any thinking and planning in advance of comprehensive immigration reform in terms of what the impact might be on caseload? It seems to me like that's a it's it's it just as it will have a tsunami effect on lots of different institutions, in thinking about this panel and thinking about you coming today, I was thinking that it would increase your caseload substantially.
I think we are all thinking about it, and I think that's the importance of the type of appointees that this administration has brought in, so that while it's not specifically in an agenda, it's the things that we bring in, and certainly they're I think we look at them as opportunities to advance the overall mission, not just leaving immigration solely up to DHS, but immigration reform and immigration issues are going to be tackled all over the administration.
And I would just say, I'm going to have to excuse myself, but I mean, something that I was remarking to one of my colleagues, Roberto Rodriguez, who is special assistant on education issues for the president at the DPC, we were remarking about there are a number of people, Martha Coven, who also works in the Domestic Policy Council, who's worked on some of these issues before in the past. There are a number of people, both at the White House and across the agencies, that are interested in this issue, and so it's a challenge to just figuring out how to coordinate, how to bring people together in the most productive forum, and that's what we're thinking through right now. But I apologize that I have to leave, and look forward to learning more and meeting more with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, Felicia. We'll take just a few more questions, please.
My name is Araceli Panameño. I'm with the Center for Responsible Lending and with the Center for Community Self-Help, Community Development Financial Institution. And my question is regarding, first, a comment. The immigrant community has made a significant financial and economic contribution to our country. FDIC and FINRA both have done surveys that document that the largest segment of the population that is unbanked and underbanked is, in fact, the immigrant community. And we have made significant attempts to bank them and to provide them access to mainstream financial services. During the last two debates over comprehensive immigration reform, even the Congress encouraged immigrant communities to buy homes, to get their ITIN numbers, individual tax identification numbers, to make their tax contributions to the IRS and to buy their homes. And many of them did. And through the housing boom and predatory lending practices, they receive predatory products. Now that the bubble has burst, and we are now in the process of investigating and even reforming the financial system, we now are actually in a position of refusing to provide assistance to immigrants who actually purchased their homes as they were encouraged to do in order to become a more integrated part of the American fabric. So my question is, what, if anything, can be contemplated in terms of providing assistance to immigrants who actually purchase their homes, who are in need of assistance with predatory mortgages, or are significantly underwater, who we also have, I think, an economic and community interest in providing assistance to, and then also as we look towards financial regulatory reform, which is being debated in the Senate today, what assurances can we offer the immigrant community to actually continue to participate in mainstream financial services? The president has incorporated Bank on USA initiative on his budget. So.
Thank you. There's only one representative of the housing industry here, housing agencies here.
And,
housing regulators. Do you want to take a cut at that, John?
Well, you know, there are a variety of issues, and I think the housing issue is very, very clear, that if the people that you described are underwater in their mortgages or have been lured into subprime loans when they didn't need to be because they qualified for something better, or on the predatory issue, the scam artists at the back end a couple of years ago are now also there saying, oh, don't pay your mortgage, just we'll pay us the money. And I travel around the country a lot, so I'm up at 5:36 in the morning. I see the ads on TV in Spanish and in English. We've got a number of efforts to deal with that with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, with a number of different organizations to deal with the victims of predatory lending. I think going forward, tomorrow I'm meeting with a group to talk about the credit scores. The people that you just described have alternative means to demonstrate their creditworthiness. And are our programs, are our provisions, regulations reflective of people with thin traditional credit files? They are creditworthy, but they're not now eligible. So we're looking at ways to try to address the unique needs and the broadened needs, because if there is a family who's foreclosed who happens to be an immigrant family, it's not just them that's affected. You walk around the neighborhoods in Las Vegas and other places, everybody's affected in that neighborhood and in that community.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Adam Edwards. I'm on the board of Upwardly Global. I have two questions, but in the interest of time, I'll stick to one. Instead of looking at the costs of immigrant integration, how can we shape the discussion towards the cost of not doing so?
It's the architect of that piece, of that, Mark was the architect of a very important piece on poverty policy in the United States before he joined the administration, and I think those were some of the tenets that were lay underneath some of your analysis, right?
Sure. I mean, I can say a word about that, although I should be very clear that that is not work that I did as part of the administration.
Right.
That exists out in the world. But the work that Michael is referring to is work that was done by a commission, by a set of academics who were asked to look at, this context, they were asked to look at the impact on the U.S. economy of sustained persistent poverty. And in the course of that, what they looked at is the effects of children growing up in sustained poverty and the adult costs and costs in relation to lost productivity, to higher health care costs, and to increased crime costs, while emphasizing that most poor children do not grow up to be people to commit crimes, and concluded that it was in the range of $500 billion a year as the drag on the U.S. economy resulting from it. So that's one kind of analysis that can be brought to it, although, again, emphasizing this was not work of the administration. I think the other thing I'd note is just when I talked earlier about our work at the Administration for Children and Families around refugee integration, it is a very strong focus on rapid linkage to employment. And it is a recognition that both involves a set of specific things around employment, but also a broader set of social services, and it is explicitly grounded in the appreciation that the sooner that people can be effectively integrated and stable participants in the workforce, it's both in their interest and it's in all of our interests.
Sherry, you have to make this argument all the time, so
make
it now.
So I'm thrilled with the question. I mean, right now, we have very little federally going on in integration, with the exception, frankly, of the folks right over here from Homeland Security who have been trying very hard to push integration and raise the issue of naturalization and participation in a civic engagement. You know, one of the reasons I believe that there is often suspicion of the foreign-born is because we don't know them. They aren't integrated. And because we aren't, oftentimes a lot of disputes end up because of just lack of knowledge, either lack of knowledge of our system or on behalf of citizens, lack of knowledge of the foreign-born. And especially this is true in the newer immigrant communities across the country. And if you look at the demographics now, almost every community is dealing with these kinds of community relations all across the country. The lack of leadership in this area makes a vacuum. And without that vacuum, others will step up. But I think in the long term, we'll all have a more active, vibrant community if everyone is participating. From a state perspective, without dealing with some of these costs, it does put incredible pressures on state budgets, on the time of community leaders. It creates real problems in terms of, equities in terms of U.S. citizens and services. It's one of the reasons why we believe so strongly the federal government has to step up and enact an immigration reform to deal with both the domestic side of it and the immigration side of it, both immigrant policy and immigration policy. But in the meantime, people are in our communities, and we are trying to do the best we can with very meager amounts of dollars. And in order to really integrate people, it will be very important for both the federal government, for the federal government to step up as a partner with state, with local government, with community organizations. And to accomplish any kind of major immigration reform, this is a critical piece.
I think that's an excellent place to stop because we are on a very tight timeline. I want to thank the panel so much for being here. Let me again thank the Kaplan Foundation for your great generosity and for sponsoring this very clear-eyed program. Thank you so much. And to self-promote for a minute, let me tell you a preview of coming attractions in the next several months. The National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy at MPI will be holding a number of forums on the effect of the recession on immigrant integration policies within different domains and at different levels of government. So we'll look forward to that.
For more information about MPI's work on immigrant integration and the 2010 E Pluribus Unum Prize award winners, please visit www.integrationawards.org.